Hello, friends. This is the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. The goal of the AlphaList podcast is to empower CTOs with the info and insight they need to make the best decisions for their company. We do this by hosting top thought leaders and picking their brains for insights into technical leadership and tech trends. If you believe in the power of accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. Plus, if you're an experienced CTO, you will love the discussion happening in our Slack space where over 600 CTOs are sharing insights, or visit one of our events. Just go to alphaList.com to apply. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. And today with me is very, very well-known, best-selling author. It's Matthew Skelton, the author of the book Team Topologies, a groundbreaking book on organizational design and software delivery. Top rated for product management. Matthew, here we go.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I'm looking forward to our discussion.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to it. So we had a pre-discussion and we said let's look at yoga for organization, for engineering organizations, and rather keep that in mind. So I'm really looking forward to this. I'm not into yoga. I hope you are.
Well, I'm not really. I wouldn't say I'm a super advanced yoga practitioner or anything like this. I've done a tiny bit. But I was actually chatting to a colleague of mine who does do yoga and some other kind of exercises. And actually, he told me it's not exactly yoga isn't quite the right metaphor. But we can talk about that in a minute, because like this is the heart of some of the things that I've realized about team topologies since the book was published.
Let's do that. But first of all, I want to know more about your personal nerd journey. I sneak into LinkedIn every time before I record a podcast and look at the profiles, and yours is quite colorful and interesting. And I always like to know, like, how did you, what initiated that the fascination for computers initially?
Well, I'll tell you what, my fascination for computers, my nerd journey goes back before that. I'm actually not a computer nerd at all. I'm actually a music nerd. So like my plan originally was to go and study music and like have a career in music. And then I had a change of heart for various reasons. And my dad back in like 1992 something, like bought like a kind of office PC for doing his work. And that was at home, and it was like it was like back in those days, like MS DOS 6, something like this.
6-2-2, most likely.
Something like this. And like I got started with it and started playing around with it, and I found it kind of intriguing. And started getting more familiar with that stuff. And then, of course, like Windows 95 came along. So we had a new machine with that on. And then I had a change of heart and decided not to pursue music as a career.
But what did you do with the computer initially? Was it just like playing or playing games or mods? Yeah, well, mods and music or something?
There was like a Guerrilla game. There were a few other bits and pieces. But what were we doing on that? We didn't actually play many games on it, to be totally honest. We were nerding out doing like birthday card invitations and stuff like this, like printing them out and things like this, like with the really early like desktop. It used to be called desktop publishing. Do you remember that? Desktop publishing. So some of that kind of stuff is what we're mostly doing with it.
So then CorelDRAW at a certain point, when Windows 3.1 was out and stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I remember that.
Like, I was messing around in the internals of the PC, like playing around with all the startup files and the memory management and that kind of thing. So like I basically got to the point where I had a reasonable understanding of how Windows worked. Windows and DOS, or to an extent, how they didn't work, and you had to kind of mess about to actually make them work properly. That was also part of the fun. anyway, I ended up deciding to go down the route around computer science, and I went to university in the south of England and did a university course on computer science and cybernetics. So that's control systems, robots, and another kind of control systems, which is actually super interesting and really, really useful, a really, really good foundation for reasoning about how things work. All kind of different systems. So we studied like planetary systems. We studied the organization as an ecosystem. That was back in like 1996, 97. And I guess that sowed the seeds of my interest.
So to interrupt you.
Yeah.
There's a guy, I think from the UK as well, Kevin Warwick, you know him?
So he was a professor. He was in charge of my department.
Yeah. I had him here.
University of Reading, once. Exactly.
Yeah. So he's fascinating.
When we were there, Kevin Warwick was like, became the first, he was pitching it as the first cyborg because he put like a chip in his arm and could open doors with his body and stuff like this. I was actually in the research group that, I was actually in the research team that was attached to his research. So I didn't do work directly with Kevin Warwick, but I was in his research team doing stuff, early work on things like RFID and things like that. I built a weather monitoring station using like a control technology that was kind of advanced at the time, like an automated weather station, data collection and blah, blah, blah. So it was really good grounding in kind of forward-thinking approaches to systems of all kinds, really. Not just the computer systems are the systems in which we can, where we can most easily like manipulate, because we can control them very straightforwardly. We got computer language we can use to control them, but you can take the principles from cybernetics and use those principles to think through other kind of systems as well, in terms of like first order, second order, third order systems, expecting things to flip into a state of expecting systems to flip from a state of kind of quiescence or where they're stable to flip into a state of like instability. And chaos, understanding chaos, why the system is doing that through feedback and things like this.
Yeah.
So I think that sowed the seeds, to be honest, for me, of an interest in or the organization as a system, which is obviously what I'm doing now. I was reflecting on what it is that really interests me professionally, and really it's effective, humane organizations. This is the three words to describe my interest effectively, my professional interest, is effective, humane organizations. And that's what Team Sporties tries to move us towards, to be totally honest. We didn't actually emphasize the humane aspect in the book enough. I wish we had. We'll be emphasizing that aspect in the next book, the humane aspect. But certainly underneath things like an attention to team cognitive load, like one of the key themes in the Team Sporties book is this recommendation to use team cognitive load as a design and a kind of architectural principle for how we think about effective services and things like that. That ultimately comes down to it being more humane, because we're not overloading people. We're not expecting them to think about a million different things at the same time. I mean, it's just not possible. We're not going to get an effective organization out if we're overloading people like that. But some of the other things as well, like the team interaction modes, again, that's like effectively an innovation in Team Topology's book. The purpose of the team interaction modes there is to provide people with a way to navigate ambiguity and difficulty in the organization, but navigate that in a way where there's some common language with other people. And that speaks to this desire to have to nudge organizations towards being more humane. So that was the start of my nerd journey, really. Like, originally I was going to do music. Switched into kind of computing and you know, cybernetics or control systems. And I think that was actually really useful for me as a foundation for thinking about all sorts of things. I continue to use it. It's there in the Team Sporties book. We reference some of the early work for like Norbert Wiener and people like that in cybernetics. I mean, cybernetics is not the only thing we need to, it's not the only lens to look at the world, but it's a useful lens, a useful starting point.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And why did you pick like the most chaotic thing then? I mean, forming looking at team topologies and organizational design, and human nature is very chaotic. Comparing that, I mean, looking at your path from engineering, could you have picked something else? Or why did you pick the most chaotic?
That's a good question. Maybe it's because, I don't know, I just found it interesting. I did a master's degree in neuroscience. So that's the brain, understanding how the brain works.
Okay.
And
okay.
That also
that explains it.
Because the way the brain works is sort of not how people expect, I guess. People have got an image of how you know nerve signals go around the body and what happens when and where, but actually a lot of that stuff is quite far from people's expectation. The brain is not a computer, basically. Whereas most people have this mental model, our brain is just a computer telling the body what to do. It isn't like that. And it gets even more weird when you start looking at other creatures like octopus, where most of an octopus's nerve cells are actually in the arms, not in the head. So like the octopus has got effectively, you might call it sort of like 9 brains, if you like. There's certainly a lot of sensation and sense-making that happens inside the octopus tentacles. They're semi-independent, but can be coordinated together. And that's almost like an alien concept, having effectively like 8 mini brains that are somewhat separate as its tentacles are moving around, but then it can kind of bring together the coordinated control when needed. Anyway, so having that perspective was definitely influenced, provided an influence for the Team Topologies book in terms of there are very different kinds of nerve cells in the body and the brain. They have different kind of specialisms. And there's different kind of ways in which they connect with other different nerve cells. And there's different kind of what's called neurotransmitter, which are the chemicals that pass between different nerve cells in order to help move information from one place to another in the brain, or help to promote or inhibit information flow. And some of that kind of thinking there goes into the Team Topologies, team types and team interaction modes. Because the brain is not homogenous. There isn't just one type of brain cell and one type of kind of communication. There's very distinct types of brain cell and distinct types of communication. And that's part of how we get the richness of ability of biological brains. Because we've got a useful amount of differentiation between different kind of processing units, if you like. And hence, we've got 4 different types of team in Team Topologies. It's actually not true, but I'll talk about that in a minute. And 3 different types of team interaction mode. And our feeling so far is certainly inside IT and probably inside other knowledge work contexts, that's just enough to express a useful richness of behavior inside organizations doing knowledge work. So there's actually 3 team types and a special grouping of teams called a platform. In the book, we call it a platform team. It's actually a grouping of teams. It's like a container or a box around other types of team. But anyway, in the book, it talks about 4 different types of team. And so I think this nerd journey, it's touched music, it's touched computers, and it's touched brain. And those things, for me, those things came together in a really useful perspective about thinking about the organization as a kind of system, or now we talk about it as a kind of complex adaptive system. We've got multiple agents and they've got different agendas, and what kind of minimum constraints, technically enabling constraints, can we put in place to help shape effective action? And that's what we really explicitly tried to do with Team Topologies. There's more work to do. We've got to describe loads of patterns and pros and cons, and there's lots of stuff we're working on. But that was the intent behind Team Topologies, to try and nudge organizations towards like humane, effective organizations, acknowledging that they're not a machine, and not acknowledging that organizations are complex adaptive systems, and therefore we need to be thinking about kind of different kind of constraints. For a lot of people, the word constraint sounds bad. but it's actually a good thing. It's like a guardrail. Like we're putting in the walls, if you like, the boxes, the side of the boxes to allow this thing to behave sensibly. And rather than just being fully unconstrained, excuse me. And so having just enough constraints in place, guardrails or whatever you want to call them, helps this organization to be much more effective. That's the main thrust of Teams Bodies, really. It's not about like organization design in itself. The design, it kind of emerges from the underlying need and principles that we've got in place.
And where do we start? I mean, you see many, you're also consulting, right? You see many ineffective organizations. What are typically the first steps? I guess you analyze it first, but what are, like, if you look at like implementing team topologies, where do you start? What is the key moment initially?
That's a good question. So where we like to start is in helping organizations to understand the scale and nature of the change that is implied by an approach like Teams Bodies. So let me just make it really clear. At one level, I'm not actually that bothered about organizations adopting Teams Bodies or not. I'm not here to push Teams Bodies and earn loads of money from it. I'm interested in, as I said, effective, humane organizations. And Teams Bodies, we wrote it in order to try and kind of bring together a whole load of principles which should help in that space. But if someone's using a slightly different collection of similar principles, that's also great. The point here is that if you're going to move towards an organization that's arranged around flows of value, that considers the cognitive load of people working there, that understands how to use technology to enhance the way in which people work, understands that the shape and responsibility boundaries inside that organization need to change on a very frequent basis, mm-hmm. because the regulation is changing, because we've got a new coronavirus, because the technologies change, and a whole bunch of other things. We need to have an organization. It's not about an organization design. We don't want to redesign the organization every 5 years or 3 years or whatever. We need to have an approach which expects us to continuously adapt and shift the responsibility boundaries and the flows and that kind of thing inside the organization. And that's what certainly the final third of the Teams Bodies book is exactly about, is patterns and principles for continuous adaptation of the organization. And there's many organizations that we work with who think, oh, we'll just do a reorganization, reorg using Teams Bodies, and then we're done. And it's like, you completely missed the point. Don't even do that, because it's not going to achieve what you think and you'll get disappointed. Like, internalize the underlying principles behind Teams Bodies and other approaches like flow engineering and a whole bunch of other things like this around value streams. And understand that we need to be adaptive. We need to fundamentally not be thinking about rigid structure. We need to be thinking about adaptive, flow-based approaches where we're bringing together proper teams, a mix of skills and experience and perspective to solve hard problems in the knowledge workspace. And that's a very different way of thinking about the organizational purpose than the past. Because in the past, the organizational purpose was something, well, the way in which people thought about solving the organizational purpose was, let's get the right structure in place. The structure in a team topology sense or in a flow-based sense emerges from the needs to have flows of value. And for some people, that shift is huge. I mean, I was just talking to an architect in a large pharmaceutical chemical company just this morning, and he was describing some similar challenges inside the organization where many people, they can see a new, like, Teams Bodies inspired design, but they're still thinking in the old way in terms of hierarchy, in terms of silos, and they just think they just have to kind of pretend it's going to be different, but they haven't made the mental leap. And it's not this organization alone by any means. It's most organizations, perhaps, that we see. Many people are not making the mental leap to fundamentally starting with flow as the most important kind of orientation of thinking. And yes, we might have some kind of reporting line. We're reporting to this manager and this manager, but the most important thing is the flow. And that fundamentally changes how we fund things. It changes how we think about success at a team and an individual level. It changes all kinds of things. And for me, I guess I'd already internalized all of that. Well, me and Manuel, my co-author, we'd already internalized all of that thinking around flow-based, kind of value flow-based approaches, because we'd been working in that space for like 10 years. And the IT industry is kind of already through things like Agile and DevOps and all that, et cetera, The IT industry already kind of sort of solved these problems, or at least discovered solutions to these problems. Like, they're not solved industry-wide, but they've discovered some useful solutions to these kind of approaches. But then there's whole, you know, outside of IT, where this stuff hasn't really been discovered fully yet, or hasn't been fully accepted, then these approaches are like completely new to so many people that it's going to take quite a long time for large organizations to switch around and go, a switch to something like Teams Polities implies a real change in how the organization almost sees itself. People inside the organization need to be honest about what the actual flows of value are. And that can be quite difficult. If we don't understand the flows of value, then we can't use Teams Polities to set up teams in the initial configuration. But in lots of organizations, no one's thought about value, which is, to my mind, is crazy, right? It's just madness. But it's the fact, like in lots of organizations, it's kind of, there's a big machine, someone's turning the handle, and you collect your paycheck, rather than thinking about what are the actual flows of value. Who are our customers, internal, external? Where's the value here? What should we be doing? What should we not be doing? But understanding the flow of value and what those value flows are is the starting point for a more effective organization operating at scale without slowing down. You can't possibly go quickly at any kind of useful scale unless you understand what the value flows really are. And then you can start to align to those value flows, and then you've got a chance of surviving.
But how do you initiate that mind shift? I mean, it's kind of natural. Like, as an engineer, you know, like pipelines, you know flow in your space, right? For many, I would say, like many, like more traditional engineering orgs, it kind of stops with the shipment, essentially, right? With the deployment, and then you don't care anymore. It's maybe there, but how, like, looking at whole organizations, how do you initiate that?
It's a really good question. And I've realized that there's a real need for to help with a mindset shift towards what I'm now calling continuous stewardship. So obviously from an IT perspective, we've had a continuous integration, continuous delivery, continuous deployment, continuous discovery. Really, there's a sense of a need for continuous stewardship of services on an ongoing basis. Like, if you think about a pension fund, like, you're going to, that service, that software enriched service managing your pension, is going to need to still be in place 50 years from now. If you start contributing to your pension when you're relatively young, that's a long time. What about your heart pacemaker or your insulin pump if you've got diabetes? Like, you're going to want that working for many decades. You don't want the startup just to shut down and then close the doors and then your insulin pump stops working, I hope. Now, there's a sense in which, because software is now so pervasive and touches so many parts of our lives, there's a responsibility for organizations that are using software in some form to provide a service. There is a responsibility for these organizations to set things up in a way where we're enabling continuous stewardship of this service that has a bit of software involved in it. Like, if there's no software at all, we still need a sense of continuous service, perhaps, but like, it's less important. But software is business software, the kind of software that we talk about in these kind of contexts, is effectively encoded intent. It's encoded business intent. And we need to understand how to manipulate and change and safely evolve that encoded intent as the business needs to evolve its offering. And so even if the majority of the service we're talking about is not actually software-based, if there is a bit of software involved somehow in making that service available, the organization needs to have the skills and awareness to understand the details of what the software is doing and how to evolve it safely, and how to evolve it in a way which kind of aligns the incentives well for the people who are involved. So we don't just have this thing of throwing something over the fence or deploying it and then we're done. We've got a sense of continuity of care on an ongoing basis. So that's something I've started to work on now around continuous stewardship. I think it's incredibly important, and I think it's a perspective which is missing from many people in many organizations. They're still thinking in terms of, oh, there's a project here. Once we've shipped it, it's done, and we don't need to care about it anymore. And that's just not true for so many situations now. We need to, if we're serious about the effect on people's lives, we need to have this sense of continuous stewardship. So getting to that perspective is what I've started to do, like emphasize that continuous nature of things.
And the next step then, I mean, you have a traditional organization that maybe has delivery, product, business, like all in different lines with all the complexity of let's say a matrix with like additional people from other teams that are involved. Like, how do you, I don't know, make people zoom out and say, hey, we're all in this together. And we have to effectively bring value to the customer. How do you initiate that, and what are the steps?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, it can be useful. What we've been playing around with some various different techniques, but one of the techniques that we've come up with is a kind of group workshop approach, where we bring together people from multiple different perspectives. To help them think about effective boundaries for flow, and help them think about the customer, and help them think about the implication of having different kind of team boundaries. So the core team apologies team group, plus people from the community have been devising some open techniques. So they're like Creative Commons, so kind of open source techniques for collaborative discussion and discovery of effective boundaries for flow. And that is a really powerful technique. For example, we ran a session a couple of years ago with people from a clothing retailer in Southeast Asia. And they had like the CTO and head of products and head of engineering, but also a bunch of other roles, but also the head of warehouse. So the head of warehouse is literally, they're involved in the physical warehouse. This is shipping goods out, taking clothing back, and then cycling it around. Apparently, I think it's increasingly common in the UK and other parts of the world, but certainly in Southeast Asia, it's extremely common even back then for people to order clothes online, try them on. If they didn't like them, they just return them. So that returns process is like a continuous flow of stuff. So they have to think about shipments and returns as a continuous flow. So people with very different responsibilities, product, technology, and logistics, all involved in the same online session, mirror board, all being able to talk about flows of value, all thinking in terms of the end customer and their needs, and working out where we would need to have different kind of teams, where we need to have different kind of platforms to reduce the cognitive load and improve the flow, where we might have enabling teams of experts who can work across different value streams and help to uplift their capability and awareness, and where there might need to be some what we call complicated subsystem teams, slightly more rare, but where there's a really awkward aspect of something where we need to bring kind of remove the cognitive load from the main value streams and kind of bring that into the complicated subsystem team. All those three different people of the perspectives of technology, product, and logistics could contribute equally, basically in that format of discussion. It was super valuable, and that kind of bringing together people in that kind of collaborative context to help them see things is something we've found to be extremely valuable and powerful when doing these kind of things. It's not a top-down design. It's a collaborative, together approach to thinking through value and organizational design, I think.
By together looking at the constraints, or let's say the end goal, the value that you want to create, and then working backwards from that, or?
Sometimes, yeah. Or sometimes we start with user needs. So we might map out a particular user. So in that case, like it's... I think there were at least two different personas. There was like a typical customer, and then there's one that was like high net worth, like the kind of person who's got loads of money and they want to buy like the pair of gold shoes or the top with silver thread or something like this, like really, really expensive or whatever it is, the extra expensive pair of sneakers. And so we start with their user needs and work backwards from there. Like, what do they need? They need if they're the high net worth customer, they need like a concierge service. How do we enable that concierge service in a physical store? What are they going to expect? They're going to expect, I don't know what it is. There's proximity sensors or there's something which recognizes them on the phone and blah, blah, blah. Work out a set of services that help to meet those needs. I work backwards from the user needs. Which for those of listeners who know about Wardley mapping, it's deliberately aligned to that. It's actually the first stage of, we use kind of the first part of the Wardley map, starting with the user and the user needs, and work down backwards from there to map out a potential set of teams to meet those user needs. It's quite an interesting technique. But sometimes we'll also, so you can start with, you can start looking at value flow, you can start looking at user needs. You can also start looking at an existing team design. It might be where they are now, or it might be that they've done some team topologies modeling and they think they've got a decent organization model based on, you know, all the team topologies, team types and the interaction modes and things. We can start with that and go, okay, this is great, but we know that this is going to be out of date in, say, 6 months or a year. How are we going to evolve it? Let's look at people's expectations about what kind of signals they're going to listen to help them evolve that expected organization. So that they've got confidence and not just confidence, but like awareness of the kind of things they need to be looking out for to detect when things are going wrong or to detect when technology's changed or regulations have changed or something else has changed, which means we now need to shift responsibility boundaries or take on a new technology or remove a technology or whatever it is to enable this organization to continuously adapt. There's a bunch of different techniques that we know of and that we've been using that really seem to help, but particularly help when we've got this collaborative approach. We can empower people then to start using that approach to have these better conversations on a day-by-day basis.
Now, a few words from our sponsors. This podcast is proudly presented by Shopify. With Shopify, you're already running the internet's best converting checkout. So how do you boost your performance in sales further? The answer is checkout extensibility. With 40 new and even more powerful API and UI components, checkout extensibility makes it simple to customize your checkout experience. Join the thousands of German businesses enjoying significant boost in performance and conversion results with checkout extensibility. Learn more at shopify.de/editionsdigest. That's it from our sponsors.
And if you connect that to software, there's Conway's law, right? And as far as I understand it, you kind of emphasize decoupling and architectural autonomy. What does that lead to if you look at the end result in software?
So, interestingly, yes. So if we want to, if we're looking to go quickly, if we want fast flow, then we definitely need decoupling. Decoupling means separating things that do not need to be together. What that means is that it can be quite counterintuitive for some people because if typically speaking in the past, we might have had, say, three teams or three bits of the system that were involved. You might have had like a data part, you might have had a services part, and you might have had a front-end part, let's say. Three teams involved. Team A is looking after the front end. They need to add a new, I don't know, a new field to some form, something really boring.
Mm-hmm. Like and, 99% of all projects, right?
Exactly, right. And how long does it take to add a new field to a form? And so Team A needs to put the new field on the website. Team B, there's a service behind it. They need to update that. And Team C needs to update the data store somehow, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is one option, which is that you have a single team owning the whole thing end-to-end, which sometimes works fine. That's totally mm-hmm. fine. There are mm-hmm. architectural patterns that enable you to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that's not the right way to do it. And up to roundabout now, up to the point where, well, up to say the middle of the 2000s, the accepted practice was to say, okay, well, Team A, you need to make that change, but for you to make that change, you need Team B to make an update, but then you need Team C to make the update too. So let's bring all that stuff together. Let's manage that like a project. Have people synchronizing it and checking when it's all ready. And then, now the change is available to make. Now we'll deploy it and it's done. The problem is this coupling of different teams and changes, specifically it's a coupling of changes in time, is the thing that slows down organizations. And it makes organizations impossible to have agility. And so the counterintuitive thing is that, yes, we need that new form field on the front end, but what we're actually going to do is decouple that in time. Make it clear that, yes, the front end team needs to make that available. There's a service in the back end which needs to make that change at some point, and there's a data change that needs to happen at some point. But what we need to do is split that in time. And so these changes then happen asynchronously, and we need then to do the work to clean up afterwards when all of the capability is actually in place. So initially, the extra form field, you know, might get stored in a local database at the front end, but then the services update might be available, in which case we might start using that. And eventually, the proper data store has been updated, in which case eventually we'll start using that proper data store. But that is it's the level of discipline that's needed for that is unfamiliar to many people, and many people just reach for project management coordination.
Yeah.
And it's tempting. It's so tempting. It's so sweet and juicy and lovely, and I'm going to eat that nice fruit. It's incredibly damaging for organizational agility to go down that route. And that's another thing I'm working on is the terminology and patterns for that kind of decoupling, but helping people understand how to manage it in terms of avoiding crazy explosion of implementation, which then is never cleared up because this is typically what happens.
Yeah, it would lead to like a lot of legacy, right?
Potentially a lot of legacy. And there's what are the disciplines involved in making sure we don't run with that legacy for too long? But that's how we those are the patterns that enable organizations to go quickly. It's the pattern specifically that Amazon Web Services has used for like more than 20 years to huge effect. So when Amazon Web Services adds a new person, they get more than one person's worth of value because of the core principles that they've got in terms of how their organization scales and the way in which they do work. And actually, you won't even read about that inside the books that Amazon publishes. There's the famous book called Working Backwards. You read it, you read between the lines. Like, I'm really trying to find it where they really talk about the stuff that makes Amazon actually work. You won't find it in there. Like, there's lots of really good stuff in there, but the core principles about decoupling in time and because to some people working in somewhere like Amazon that do this stuff, it's really obvious. Like, why would you want to work any other way? Like it's almost like too obvious to state, and yet it's something that does need stating as a way of working. If you want to operate at huge scale with good business agility, without slowing down and without adding extra cost all the time, you have to adopt some fundamentally different operating principles compared to the traditional organizations of the past.
Interesting. I mean, it's, yeah, obviously it different way of thinking. You initially told me about four different team types, right? Like, what are those team types? To maybe get started there, like.
So I mentioned these a little bit earlier. We've got in the book we talk about four different team types. There's actually three with a special kind of grouping. The first one, the stream-aligned team, is a cross-functional team, small number of people, up to about 8 or 9, aligned to a particular flow of value. And there are no handoffs in their work. So they look after a particular service or product or user journey or whatever. They might look after more than one, depends on the size of that thing. So if there's a particular application or user journey or something which is very small, maybe they could look after 2 or 3. That's fine. But the point is there's no handoffs. And the reason there's no handoffs is because we want that value to flow as very quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. Because handoffs introduce huge delays in organizations.
Because of like synchronization, right? Yeah.
Because of synchronization and wait times and all this kind of stuff. And there's lots of mathematics behind it. But basically, yeah. One of the best things we can do to improve flow in an organization is avoid handoffs. So we avoid handoffs. These people are, if we're talking about a software service, these people are on call. So you build it and you run it. And there's a mix of skills in there. Now, in an ideal, it's like to an extent, in an ideal world, they would look after everything. But clearly, let's say, for example, if we're building some kind of software service, you're going to need, you're probably building something in the cloud. You'll need to think about data, security, kind of governance, performance, a whole bunch of other things like this. You can't possibly like build everything yourself. You want to rely on other things that other mm-hmm. people provide, mm-hmm. cloud providers or whoever. And so to have a good flow of value, a good fast flow of value, some things you're going to need to consume from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'd be slowed down. You'd be having to think about too many things. So there's a balance here between fast flow, where we're actually dealing with quite a lot of stuff ourselves because we're not depending on anyone else. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, we've increased our cognitive load too high, and therefore we can't focus on the main mission. The main mission being, I don't know, to allow someone to buy a pizza or to update their address or, I don't know, whatever it is, something, to make a bank transfer. And so we're thinking about having good flow, fast flow of value inside our team, but also making sure we're not exceeding our cognitive load. And so the other three team types are really about dealing with cognitive load. So we've got an enabling team, which is a team of experts who can help a streamlined team, this first team type. The enabling team can help the streamlined team to uplift their capabilities, to explain to them how to use a new technique or technology or something so that actually their cognitive load is then reduced. They can take on more work. They can work in a better way. It's more effective and it improves flow. And the enabling team there just works with them for a short period of time. There might be different kinds of enabling teams focused on different things, but they're only working with streamlined teams for a shortish period, a few days or a few weeks at most. So they never become a dependency or bottleneck. Sometimes the nature of the cognitive load in a streamlined team is it's cognitive load which is related to something very complicated. So let's say it's like a video processing algorithm or something like that. It would require people who are far too specialized inside a streamlined team to work on that video processing algorithm. So we take that cognitive load out and we give it to what's called a complicated subsystem team. And there's people who go specialize in that particular area. Mm-hmm. But the way in which they provide that video processing algorithm is like as a service eventually. So it's easy for the streamlined team to consume, easy for them to work with. It's got a good user experience when working with that particular component. And part of the way in which that complicated subsystem team is measured is the extent to which they improve or help flow in the teams that use it. And then finally, we've got the concept of a platform. In the book, we talk about platform team, but that's not quite accurate. It's more like a platform is more like a grouping of teams in most organizations. You'll have multiple teams inside this boundary, effectively. The platform is there to do something quite similar to a complicated subsystem. It's just the platform is providing multiple services. So the purpose of the platform is to improve flow by reducing cognitive load inside these streamlined teams. Now, that's a very different perspective of what a platform is for, and it's a deliberately different perspective. It's about flow and cognitive load. It's not about saving costs, sharing services, blah, 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 any of these other things. Those other things will tend to happen, but we're primarily focused on maintaining or improving flow by reducing cognitive load. Mm-hmm. And it provides a really useful perspective for how we should think about using platforms. So those are the four different types of team. It's really three different types of team plus a grouping. But we need to think well beyond just structure. It's not just about structure. It's about how teams interact. Also, there's three team interaction modes as well. There's collaboration, which is two teams working together for a period of time to adjust their responsibility boundaries. Then we've got facilitation, which is one team helping another team to uplift their capabilities. Typically, that's used by enabling teams. And then finally, we've got X as a service. So one team is providing something and one team is consuming something as a service. So it's quite friction-free. There's very little interaction needed on a day-to-day basis, and it scales quite well. And it's the dynamic between these different interaction modes which is really important. So we don't have a static relationship between teams. We're listening for when we need to shift into a different interaction mode. And that's part of what then makes the teams' bodies much more adaptive and dynamic. It's not about structure. It's about the dynamic relationships and needs that different teams have with an ability to adjust our boundaries, our responsibility boundaries for flow. As new technology comes in, as new regulation comes in, as new whatever skills and things come into the organization. So that's where the real value in teams' bodies comes from. It's not just about different team types. That stuff is table stakes. If you're really going to use teams' bodies effectively, you need to look at the team interaction mode and understand how that applies to your organization and what power it gives the people in the organization, really, what new capability it brings to the organization to be able to adapt continuously to changing business and regulatory needs and ecosystem needs.
So in practice, that means that there is a team that understands the customer needs. It basically wants to implement like 99% or like basically everything. And then there are other teams that help that team to kind of succeed and that are specialized in certain areas. Like, let's say marketing or AI or database. Like wherever you can have problems, then those other teams would jump in and try to fix or help to really like improve the value that is generated at the end, right? Which is measurable. Is it like that?
I wouldn't say the other teams jump in necessarily, because that would indicate we've got something wrong. But the other teams are contributing in the sense that they're helping with the flow of value. We've thought about the cognitive load. We've thought about the kind of capabilities that should sit inside the streamlines team, which is closest to the customer. But crucially, we've also thought about who are our customers? Who are the customers internally and externally? Because there's loads of organizations that don't think about that. Just as loads of organizations don't think about the flow of value, they've not thought about who their customers are and what those customer needs are. And so Teams Bodies helps to nudge organizations towards that approach. Let's understand who our customers are, external and internal. Let's understand what the flows of value are. And then once you understand that, to be honest, that's actually a massive chunk of the problem of slow organizations solved. Because once we understand the users, their needs, and the flows of value, then we're in a much better place compared to where most organizations are, or many organizations are. And then a lot of the teams body stuff kind of flow almost comes naturally after we've understood what those user needs and flows of value are. Not everything, but a lot of it falls into place kind of naturally after that.
But to kind of complete the example, like I have a team that like is responsible for a product like end to end, commercially, product wise, etc., which is like a small company. And then you have another team which maybe is experts in SEO and experts in marketing, and they are kind of now organized in a matrix organization, so that one wants the other to, I don't know, collaborate, and maybe this marketing team also has ideas and thinks like, hey, I know things better, and it's all great, but the collaboration doesn't work because they are basically in different areas or different parts of the organization, hierarchically, in the hierarchy, just in totally different areas. How do you get them to effectively collaborate then?
Right. So in Teacher Polity's terminology, collaboration is a very specific thing. And we only do collaboration in order to adjust boundaries for flow, which sounds strange because a lot of people think more collaboration is better. But what we are doing is we're basically ignoring the hierarchy. Hierarchy is just a terrible place to start for any useful value delivery in any kind of organization. It's needed in terms of who reports to who and, you know, and kind of staff welfare and things like that. But most of the time, hierarchy in organizations is a useless place to start. It's not a helpful mental model for thinking about how decisions are made, and far better start with the flows of value. And if we take your example there, what if we're trying to enable, let's say, a team that's focused on some sort of digital product, what kind of awareness and skills do they need to be able to do that accurately and safely and compliantly? They need some expertise from some content people, maybe, or some user experience people. Maybe you can have a design platform. Maybe the Streamlined team could consume some patterns and templates from a design platform to help them make things consistent. But maybe they also need some input from like data specialists, I don't know, around like GDPR or some regulation like that. So then we might have an enabling team of experts who can help the Streamline team to understand the constraints around the use of data or the way in which data needs to be displayed or shared or something else. So they might help uplift the awareness inside that Streamline team for a couple of days or weeks. And maybe there's an aspect of that product which needs a complicated subsystem involved. It's something about the way in which we're processing some data or something. And we need to bring that kind of cognitive load out of the Streamline team somewhere else to help them own their product better. So we're not thinking in terms of hierarchy. We're thinking in terms of what we're providing to other groups inside the organization. Mm-hmm. It becomes like an ecosystem of providers inside the organization. That's the mental model that is far more effective to think about. And that model, ecosystem of providers, is hugely scalable. So there's the big Chinese white goods manufacturer Haier, and they worldwide say sales of huge numbers of billions. And they've got a model which effectively is like an ecosystem of providers like that. And there's plenty of other organizations that have a similar kind of model. What's happening there is that we're decoupling. We're thinking about value. We're thinking about customers, internal and external. We're not thinking about the hierarchy in terms of communication. We're thinking in terms of whom do we need to communicate with in order to provide value. Mm-hmm. And that gets to the heart of a very different mindset for organizational, like a different operating model, if you like. If it's just about who do we need to communicate with in order to provide value, then the hierarchy goes out the window. The hierarchy is just not important at that point, which is how it should be.
It's more like
the hierarchy should only be there for emergencies and for like employee well-being, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Means that you basically build a service catalog, right?
Yeah, it's an ecosystem with lots of different service providers internally.
Yeah, sounds cool.
Were we going to talk about yoga and that kind of thing? I think we promised it, right?
We missed the yoga aspect. Yeah. How does that connect?
I could talk about it a little bit. And what we've really realized is that you can see Teacher Polity as like, imagine the organization is like a body, like a person. And it's actually there in the word. Certainly in English, we talk about corporation. Now, the word corporate comes from the Latin word for body. It's a body of people. So imagine this body is going to the gym for exercise, a fitness studio. We might pay a we've got a goal. We might want to run a marathon. We might want to improve our climbing. We might want to learn how to do ballet. We've got a goal that's, you know, we're doing a thing. It's going to take some time. And we're going to need to do some strength training and some foundational training to help us get there. Now, I don't know about you, but I've run a half marathon. I've never run a marathon, but I know people who have run marathons. And if you do not do proper training for a marathon, you will injure yourself. You will either fall down at like 26. Mile 18,
yeah.
Or you will injure yourself and break a leg or rupture a muscle or whatever it is. You need to do the strength training. And team topology is like that strength training. It's about being aware of your body, the different parts and how they relate to each other, and the relationships between those different parts. Getting more familiar with team topology gives you the language and awareness to help you understand what your body can do. Is it ready to do a half marathon? Is it ready to do a full marathon? Because so many organizations try, their aim is, oh, we're going to be in the top five in the world for like digital logistics, or top five in the world for whatever it is, some consumer retail, whatever. It's a great ambition. You're going to go on a marathon? Good. Good on you. That's a really good thing to do. But you're nowhere near ready. You don't have the core strength and physical awareness of your body to be able to do that. You're going to damage yourself, or you're going to fall down before you get there. So this is what we've realized. Team topology provides that kind of core strength, kind of training and awareness to enable the organization to do really good things. The equivalent of running a marathon or going climbing or going doing ballet or whatever it is. Now, technically speaking, it's not yoga. Yoga it comes from the place of kind of, some mysticism and that kind of thing, which is fine. The thing that's closest is actually Pilates. I think Pilates is like a registered trademark. But anyway, that kind of approach, which is much more focused on bodily awareness, training, and the kind of dynamics of how the body moves. So team topologies is kind of like Pilates for the whole organization. If we get team topologies in place, there's a whole lot of other things that we can do in terms of agility and in terms of things that are quite ambitious, like the equivalent of running a marathon, the equivalent of changing how the whole organization works to become much more nimble. And it feels to me like that's the right metaphor. So like, team topology doesn't specify a load of things. It doesn't specify things that you would expect if you want to go climbing, or it doesn't specify things if you want to go to run a marathon. But that's deliberate, because it's like the core strength training. And then it connects well to other disciplines that are more focused on other outcomes. So for us, that's the mental model. I have realized that personally, I actually need to go and learn how to do Pilates myself, so I can talk about this like from direct experience. So that's my personal challenge for 2024 is to actually...
Or maybe run a marathon. Run a marathon,
exactly. But what I do know is that if I want to run a marathon, I need to do Pilates first. That's going
to
help me.
Okay, I also have to start with that, I guess, and potentially also read your book, as it seems to be like... It's quite a complex topic, like also to talk about it in a podcast, I just realized, but there seems to be like many, let's say, eye-opening ideas that you thought about a lot. And I don't know how long it will take to adopt those core fundamentals. But I think it sounds very, very helpful.
We're on a mission to help organizations do exactly this. Like we are not here to make money. I recently recorded a video for my colleagues in Citation Properties, and I said, look, if in 4 or 5 years' time I've made multiple millions of euros for myself, something's gone wrong. Like, I am not here to make money. I want to make a living, but I'm not here to make money. This is not a money-making exercise. We're on a mission to make organizations more humane and more effective around the world. That's what we're doing. We're properly driven by that. When, as long as we've got enough money to live, we're happy. We're not here to, this is not a money-making exercise. You can see that because we closed off the certification route. There's no way to be a Teen to Poverty certified anything. It doesn't exist. And that's deliberate because we don't want to fall into the trap that lots of these other IT organizations and plenty of other kinds of organizations worldwide have fallen into, which is going down the certification route. It's very lucrative. You can earn loads of money from it, but we're not interested in that. We're here on actually a proper mission to make organizations more humane and more effective. Cool. So we'll be here helping organizations doing that for the foreseeable future. And we'll be putting out more like information. There'll be a new book coming soon that I'll write with Manuel, my co-author from the first book. It won't be coming immediately, but we've started work on thinking through how to what goes into that second book.
Cool. I still have a little surprise for you. And by the way, it also doesn't look as if there's a Ferrari key in front of you on your desk. Eh? But I still have a little surprise for you. Your co-author you just mentioned, Manuel, told me about a never published chapter about how to physically travel in time, which you kind of, because it had some side effects, abandoned at a certain point. And I actually read it. And we now have the chance, hopefully without any side effects, to theoretically travel back in time to the year 1998, when you started working as a network engineer at RM, a company called RM. And you now have the chance to whisper something into young Matthew's ears. What would you whisper to yourself?
That's a really nice question. I think I would... I think I'd probably say a couple of things. I'd say one, it's the same thing, really. The same thing is have the confidence to listen to yourself and what drives you. Have the confidence to listen to that more carefully and to trust in it, but also have the confidence to listen to customers and other people and really, really understand and value what they need as well. And really lean on the emotional aspect, lean on the what it means to be human, lean on that kind of that real need or desire in the different people have got, and use that to help arrive at decisions and solutions and possibilities more quickly and more effectively, I guess is what I'd say. I guess I've, after the book was published, Manuel and I think, I can't speak for Manuel directly, but I'm pretty certain he might say something similar. Like we didn't really expect the success. We weren't super confident initially in pursuing this further. But I've certainly reconnected with some of the really meaningful stuff for me, which was behind why I wrote the book. And that's about the humane aspect. And actually leaning into that really core aspect has really helped me to work out where I want to focus and why I'm involved in this kind of work.
So stop doing networking stuff. Start thinking about humane organizations. Great. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Matthew. It was great talking to you.
And, thanks for being here.
Maybe like a few more words on your future book. When is it coming out? How people can interact with you?
So I think there'll be an interim book around continuous stewardship. To talk about that the need for this continuous perspective on building and running human facing services. The second main Team to Ponies book, we've not got a date yet. We've not actually started. We haven't even written the abstract or the outline yet. So like books take at least a year between finishing the manuscript and publication, basically. So like it's not going to be in 2024. It won't be in 2025. Maybe 2026. Maybe. So we're not promising anything, but we've got agreement in principle from the publisher IT Revolution to do a second book. So like it will happen. It's a question of manually finding the time. The focus of the second book is almost certainly going to be about how to use Team to Ponies principles outside of IT and also at multiple different scales.
Cool.
Because good. That's what people are already doing. They're already using the ideas outside of IT and at lots of different scales, large organizations, medium, small, startups, scale-ups, whatever, but also in legal services, healthcare, mm-hmm. marketing, academia, a whole load of other places using the Team to Ponies ideas. So that's what it will be. Effectively, the first book was based on what we knew, which was IT, fine.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were saying it's applicable outside of IT, pretty much knowledge work in general, but also lots of different scales of organization, large, medium, small.
So that's what you're analyzing your users now, essentially.
Yeah, to seeking inspiration from what they're doing and what they're telling us about what they've already done. Like this is not necessarily just organizations that we've worked with. In many cases, organizations that are coming to us saying, hey, look at this great stuff we've done here. And we're going, wow, that's amazing.
Cool. And last words, where can folks find you?
So if you go to teamtopologies.com, if you search for Team Topologies, you'll find us online. We're not hard to spot. We're very pleased to be adding some amazing people to our core team. We're starting to expand into APAC, North America, eventually South America too, other parts of EMEA, and we've got our partner program. It started to grow, and that the purpose of that is to really enable this adoption of much more effective ways of working using Team Topologies, but for these humane, effective organizations. So we're really committed to making that work. But if you search for Team Topologies or go to teamtopologies.com, you'll find the details there.
Cool. Thanks a lot for your time and have a great day.
Super. Thank you, Tobias.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the AlphaList podcast. If you like this episode, share it with friends. I'm sure they love it too. Make sure to subscribe so you can hear deep insights into technical leadership and technology trends as they become available. Also, please tell us if there is a topic you would like to hear more about or a technical leader whose brain you would like us to pick. AlphaList is all about helping CTOs getting access to the insights they need to make the best decisions for their company. Please send us suggestions to cto@alphalist.com. Send me a message on LinkedIn or Twitter. After all, the more knowledge we bring to CTOs, the more growth we see in tech. Or, as we say on AlphaList, accumulated knowledge to accelerate growth. See you in the next episode.